It is more than a myth. Perhaps blood is telling. She crossed the room and sat in one of the fuchsia chairs, like she had ascended to a throne. I always felt your familial strife had an air of history. She lingered on the word, repeating itself, as if the seed of rebellion was planted in your DNA. Polly rested his arm on the back of his sister's chair, then produced, seemingly from nowhere, a vaporizer. He gave a slight cough to gain Hugo's attention, and when Hugo looked his way, he put the inhaler to his lips and wiggled his fastidiously shaped eyebrows.
Thanks, man, Hugo said. I'm good.
Suit yourself. Polly slipped out of the room, headed, Alice suspected, to one of the small hidden courtyards, not uncommon in the quarter. Art gestured to the sofa, the invitation a sure sign Alice's night was far from over. Nicholas and Celestin. She adjusted her robe so it better covered her thigh. Luke and Nicholas, the upstart son challenging the harsh, distant father. Who knows how many generations back this particular drama has played itself out? Hugo dropped to the sofa, seeming pleased to dig into what Alice considered an old and best forgotten wound. But then again, he hadn't been there to witness Luke's murder. Alice considered joining Apollo and his vaporizer.
So our great-great-grandpappy, Hugo said, glancing up at Alice with shining, gleeful eyes, was literally the devil himself.
He patted the seat beside him.
That would explain a lot.
Alice would have preferred to excuse herself and head home, but she found herself a victim of her own curiosity. She sat beside her brother.
I will do you the favor of assuming you are being deliberately obtuse.
Art looked from Hugo to Alice.
Do feel free to kick off your shoes and pull your feet up, Charlie. Make yourself at home.
Then back to Hugo.
I'm not talking about the devil. I'm talking about Lucifer, the bringer of light, the initiator to hidden wisdom.
3 blocks from here, Alice let her words trail off, not having intended to speak aloud. The absinthe must have lowered her inhibitions. Realizing all eyes were fixed on her, she committed to her statement. 3 blocks from here is a building full of clerics who will be happy to remind you this initiation caused the fall of man. Hugo smiled at Alice, then turned to Artemis, raising his eyebrows and cocking his head as if daring her to accept a challenge.
Oh, she said, relishing, it seemed, the chance to do so. But that's their version of the story. In mine, Lucifer is a Prometheus figure, punished for illuminating that which the gods wished to keep hidden. He's the demiurge, the force that converts energy into matter, the one that spins potentiality into reality, or at least creates the illusion of an objective reality.
Artemis delivered her discourse as if she thought Alice, whom she seemed to consider a neophyte, would find her thesis provocative. But the woman's story wasn't original. Alice knew the twin had inherited it third hand, the Cathars having adopted it from the Gnostics, who, in turn, had adapted it from the ancient Greek philosophers. Alice was considering revealing the true provenance of Artemis's heresy when the sound of Daniel's voice derailed her thoughts.
No one likes a know-it-all, Alice, my love.
It felt like more than an encroaching memory this time. She could almost feel Daniel's presence, but that might be expected after attending his wake, especially considering her heretofore limited experience with alcohol.
Artemis interpreted Alice's agitation as a reaction to her own words, and, encouraged by the effect she thought she was having on Alice, her voice grew more animated. The sages used to speak of the music of the spheres, a great harmony they thought filled the universe. But that great harmony is nothing more than a fairy tale. She shifted in her chair, leaning toward Alice. This world wasn't built upon harmony. It was created through dissonance. The reality we know couldn't exist without it. She seemed to realize she was growing heated as she spoke. She leaned back, assuming a regal pose and an enigmatic smile that could challenge the Mona Lisa's. That is the fall of which your clerics speak. The shift from a plane of perfect and infinite potential to an imperfect and finite reality. Your priests dream of the day when this world dissolves into light, but all they're really craving is the resolution of the true original sin, the state of dissonance that allows us to exist. Perhaps this questioning of what was and wasn't real was the reason Daniel felt so close tonight. Shreds of Art's ramblings seemed to hold a sheen of truth, but Alice suspected this was another area where truth could only be glimpsed as it flitted by on the periphery, and even then, only by focusing on the negative space surrounding it. Alice had spent most of her life questioning what was real and what was true, first in the hospital on Sinclair and then, to an even greater degree, on the Dreaming Road. Maybe it was the late night. Maybe it was the effects of the absence, but Alice felt a shadow lingering on the edge of her psyche. The image of a ropey black snake slithering across a snowy field flashed into her mind. Polly returned. The scent of a peppery floral perfume attempting to override the smell of skunk rubbed in thyme that preceded him into the room. Hugo looked up at the returning twin, sniffed, then wrinkled his nose.
$1,500 an ounce caron poivre to cover up that stink of your... Wait, let me guess.
He paused and sniffed again.
$35 a pound kush?
Polly looked down his nose at Hugo, then waved his hand in front of himself, causing his scent to waft toward them. He turned his attention to his sister.
Have you finished with your sermon, ma chère Frangine?
Yes?
Good, he said, without giving her even a beat to respond. She takes such pleasure in her blasphemy.
He paused and smiled beatifically down on them.
I do hope you won't find me an inhospitable host, but dawn isn't far off, and I should put these old bones to bed.
Oh, Alice said, half embarrassed for overstaying their welcome, but entirely happy to have been dismissed. We're so sorry to have kept you up.
I'm not, Hugo said, running his hand down his face, but then he stood and stretched.
Don't forget your masks, children, Art said, pulling her legs up sideways into the chair.
Polly crossed to Alice and offered her his hand.
Lovely to see you again, Alice. It really is.
Rather than take his hand, Alice startled and rubbed her eyes. She was experiencing a hallucination, imagining the black snake from her vision had coiled around Polly's hand, pulsing and breaking into segments.
Oh dear, Polly continued, causing Alice to look up from his hand.
He was regarding her with mild concern, likely for good reason. His skin appeared to have grown translucent, and she could see the inky snake slithering just beneath it, slipping down from his head and coming out of his mouth. She had the odd impression it wasn't really Polly speaking, but the serpent revealing itself through him.
Perhaps you should get her home, Art said.
Alice glanced over to witness a serpent wriggling beneath her skin, too, down her cheek.
I'm fine, Alice said, rising to her feet.
I'm fine, she repeated, trying to reassure herself more than the others. Her eyes fell to her own hand, only to see the snake writhing there like short, dark veins. It darted deeper, disappearing within her flesh. Her knees buckled, but she felt Hugo's arm reach out and wrap around her.
Come on, Lightweight, Hugo said. Let's get you to bed.
Alice nodded and, with her eyes closed, leaned against her brother's shoulder. 17. It was going on 3 a.m., but Evangeline felt no hurry to get back to an empty, or mostly empty, if you count it sugar, bed. Mostly empty, she decided. There was no way not to count a cat who delivered menacing ultimatums one moment, then called you Mama the next. A cat who would stretch herself across the comforter and gaze at Evangeline as unblinking and, Evangeline occasionally suspected, all-seeing as the eternal Sphinx. But it wasn't a too-quiet house that had kept her at Bonne Nouvelle, her only companion, the painting of Daniel, she'd moved to the storage room for safekeeping until Alice came back to claim it. Evangeline had stayed here tonight because she was waiting for something, though she hadn't known what until she caught sight of the girl standing across Bourbon Street, awash in the cold white of a waiting taxi's headlights, her abject gaze fixed on Evangeline, waiting and willing herself to be seen. Lincoln had taken to calling the slight street kid Ghost Girl, after Evangeline had made a number of attempts to point her out to him, only for the girl to fall back behind a wall or lose herself in a crowd before he could spot her. Of course, she had chosen to show herself again while Lincoln was away in Natchitoches. Evangeline had first noticed her a couple of weeks ago, spindly and pale, the waif wore dirty, garish, oversized sweats she'd either found on the street or stolen from a souvenir shop. She looked to be 10, maybe 12. Evangeline found it difficult to guess her age from her size, malnourished as she appeared to be. Her straight blonde hair hung in dirty tangles. Dark purplish-brown circles cradled her eyes. But for the color of her hair, the girl was a goddamned mirror. A mirror that could bend time, reflecting not the woman Evangeline Casey had grown into, but the feral adolescent she had once been. From that first sighting, Evangeline had wanted, felt compelled even, to do something for the girl. There was no doubt her desire sprang from concern for the child's well-being, but she couldn't pretend her motivation was undiluted altruism. A good dose of yearning to set old wrongs right hitchhiked along with her philanthropy. Evangeline had gone through a lot growing up, and she had done things she wasn't proud of in order to survive. A gnawing in her gut seemed to promise her that if she could help a child, this child in particular, she'd be cleaning the slate. The ragamuffin had taken to slinking up and down Bourbon Street, relying on the kindness of some of its daily changing strangers and the carelessness of others. She had first caught Evangeline's attention as she was weaving her way, unaccompanied, through a throng of day drinkers, each toting a plastic neon green grenade. It had taken Evangeline less than an instant to divine the girl was surveying the crowd, searching out the softest mark. No sooner had that thought registered than the child bumped into a rotund man whose overburdened Celtic cross t-shirt stuck out like a shelf over his camouflage hunting pants. On impact, he reached up with his free hand to grasp the bill of his red baseball cap, pushing past the girl as she lifted his wallet from his back pocket,
without ever rousing his drink-dimmed suspicion. Evangeline had never, even for a heartbeat, considered alerting the guy to his loss. Honor among thieves, perhaps, or maybe the sympathy of someone who had once walked in an orphan's shoes. Indeed, her first thought had been to hope the Mark's bar-crawling itinerary had included a recent stop at an ATM, so the puny pickpocket's take would be worth the risk. Even as the clown had stumbled on unaware, the girl stopped cold and turned, as if by instinct, to face the only witness to her offense. Their eyes locked, and the girl's sense of despondency punched through with such intensity that, even if Evangeline hadn't been reaching out with her empathic powers to read the girl, it would have taken her breath away. Open as Evangeline had allowed herself to be, the sensation struck her like the sudden, shrill feedback from a microphone, leaving her rattled and dizzy. Before she could recover, the girl turned away and darted down Bourbon. Evangeline lost sight of her as she flitted up St. Peter toward Congo Square. But the look in the girl's eyes, the ferocious innocence of a wounded animal, had haunted her for days. Evangeline knew that look. She knew what it felt like to go to bed hungry for stretches of days at a time. By the third day, you can't stop shivering, even on the hottest night, wrapped up in a heavy, itchy gray wool army blanket that has been knocking around in this world longer than you have. How the old man who runs the convenience store by the factory catches you stealing a candy bar, then takes one look at you and hands you a loaf of bread and a gallon of milk to go with it. How you intuit all charity is short-lived, so you learn to become a more adept thief. Tonight, the girl had stood waiting, watching, her imploring gaze fixed on Evangeline. But before Evangeline could go to her, something caught the girl's attention from the direction of Toulouse Street. She glanced over, then turned away, her eyes grazing Evangeline once more as she began walking, a brisk but not panicked pace, in the opposite direction toward Conti. Evangeline bolted after her without a second thought. She had crossed over Conti before realizing she had left Bonne Nouvelle empty and wide open. She called after the girl to wait, but the waif took off running, increasing the distance between them each second. The girl was young and fleet and, unlike Evangeline, she hadn't been doing shots all night. She was slipping away already a block ahead. To Evangeline's surprise, she stopped for a moment, glancing back over her shoulder as if to ensure she was still being followed. A clamoring rose up from the street ahead as a mixed group of drunks, male and female, in identical Santa Claus costumes, stumbled from a karaoke bar onto the street. They shouted and hurled raucous Merry Christmases at all those they encountered, then started howling out a rough-voiced rendition of Silent Night, a cacophony that sounded more like a battle cry than a carol. One rough Santa snatched at the girl as she tried to run past the inebriated rabble, catching her by the hand and screaming, "What do you want Santa to bring you?" The child responded with a hard kick to his groin. As he dropped to his knees before her, she tugged her hand from his grip and slapped his face. Having served up the fight, the girl now opted for flight. She sped down Bourbon at a pace Evangeline could never hope to match, to the accompaniment of the man's obscenities and his gang's laughter. Evangeline dodged across the street to avoid getting caught up in the tangle of red suits, but her effort came too late. The girl was gone. Evangeline opened herself up, sending her energy out like radar, waiting for it to bounce back. A sense of loss, tinged with rage, punched her in the chest. Evangeline turned and began running up Bienville, away from the river. and then it happened. The transformation was nearly complete before she'd even registered it had begun. Her clothing dissipated like vapor, and her field of vision widened as sprinting gave way to flight. No compelling force or lunar phase controlled Evangeline's transformations now. There was no pain, no disembodied voice to taunt her and tempt her with promises of sweet release, no hellish fermata retarding the process until it seemed time itself stood still. Now she could change form in a blink, but the gift came at a cost. In that blink, Evangeline touched darkness, and the darkness touched her.
"Each change, ma chère, will make you less of what you were and more of what you will be,"
her mother's sister witch, the ancient Margot, had said. Margot's words had seemed not so much a warning as a blunt statement of what the crone had considered to be an inescapable truth. Margot was gone now, as was the even more ancient addled Mathilde. The same power that had been forcing Evangeline's tortured transformations had turned the pair to dust. Evangeline had watched as the third sister witch, Marceline, destroyed herself. Rather than suffer the yoke that had once controlled Evangeline's mother, a necklace forged to separate a witch from her power, Marceline had offered herself as a sacrifice to the dark man, the all-consuming shadow that, while not the source of magic, served as the conduit through which all magic flowed, in the hope of being restored. Only after Marceline's destruction did Evangeline learn this sorceress, who had orphaned her by snatching her father into a starless night sky and dropping him so his head burst like a hot watermelon, had been her mother's sister by blood. Her aunt. Blood. Bad blood. Spilled blood. Anyone else might have celebrated the murderous witch's annihilation, but their deaths, especially Marceline's, had severed the last tie Evangeline had to her mother, taking away any chance to learn who her mother had been before she had signed her name in the dark man's book. Soaring above the Vucaré rooftops, Evangeline could see all. The late-night revelers bathed in a neon glow, the whirling blues and reds of police car lights, the street corners ruled alternately by spirited musicians and insolent panhandlers, the street lamps glinting off the pocket change tributes passers-by offered both. And, of course, her quarry. The aerial vantage had helped her spot the child in moments. The girl had passed out of the quarter on Rampart. She paused at Canal Street, then darted against the light across six lanes of traffic and the median that separated them, creating a symphony of blaring horns and screeching brakes on both sides of the common ground. She continued until she reached Gravier, where she turned right, away from the river. Suddenly, as if she'd been winded, her pace slowed to a walk. Arriving at the common ground separating the directions of Loyola Avenue, the child looked up and raised her hand in greeting. The child knew her even in this form. Evangeline swooped lower in a wide circle, catching sight of a movement in her peripheral vision as she did, a creeping shadow that took the shape of a man even as she focused on it, as if her attention had given it form. It lurched forward in a jerky bear walk along the edge of Duncan Plaza, pausing and lifting its head in a manner that reminded Evangeline of a predator sniffing the wind to catch the scent of its prey. Its neck elongated, stretching to a length far greater than any actual human beings could. Its head snaked forward and fixed on the girl, who appeared unaware of the entity's presence as she passed it. If anything, the child remained fixated on Evangeline, spinning around once and gazing up, moving along once she was sure Evangeline still followed overhead. The staggering shadow's movements gained fluidity, even as it began a violent chattering. It slipped onto the street, shielding itself needlessly behind a parked car. The girl continued, not hearing, not seeing. With a shriek, it bounded onto the roof of the car and began to turn in place, its head flailing back and forth. Evangeline realized the shadow was sounding a warning. No, it was calling others to the hunt. It pounced from the car roof to the asphalt, its landing silent. Evangeline intuited the child's lack of fear prevented the shadow from claiming her. If the girl perceived what stalked her, she would flee and seal her fate in doing so. Nothing was more tempting to a predator than the sight of its prey bolting in panic. The girl approached the long deserted charity hospital and slipped behind the plastic traffic barricade as two more shadows, one coming from each direction of LaSalle Street, crept up to join their brother. Another quick glance up from the child as she grasped the top of the chain-link fence and tensed, preparing to pull herself up and over it. Evangeline also tensed, readying to swoop down between the creatures and the unsuspecting child. But rather than charge the girl, the three shadows drew toward one another, sparring, she sensed, for dominance, till two bowed their heads. A gust of wind rose up around them, carrying with it a scent as acrid as sulfur, but as sweet as myrrh. As they joined together into a single black mass, she flashed back to the day of Celestin Marin's trial. An involuntary cry, a husky, corvid caw, pealed from her as she recognized this shadowy being as the demon she had sensed lurking around the tombs of Pré-sur-Saint Cemetery. She'd been fool enough to leave herself open, and it had reached in and rattled her bones, turning the breath in her lungs to ice. In a flash, she'd recognized it as one of the hungry shadows Fleur told her Daniel reported encountering on the Dreaming Road. This shadow had the same energy to it as the dark entity Evangeline herself had sensed lurking in Pré-sur-Saint. The girl froze and looked up at her. The demon's head twisted a full rotation as its neck stretched up toward the sky. Evangeline dove down to take a defensive position between child and demon, flapping her wings and cawing with all the fury her terror could stoke. The demon hesitated and let loose a blood-curdling howl that seemed to combine confusion and rage with submission. It retreated, splitting into its original three components as it did. Evangeline heard the chain-link fence behind her rattle and turned back. Her left eye saw the child had slipped over the perimeter fence and beneath a lower section of an inner fence that stretched between two of the former medical center's wings. Evangeline looked back to find the demons, too, had vanished, leaving her alone in the night. She flapped her wings, preparing to fly over the fence and seek out the terrified child. Once over, she had changed back into her true form. As she passed over the inner stretch of fencing, however, she caught sight of a glint of metal at the foot of the fence. On the ground where the child had slipped through the fence lay a necklace, an unclasped chain whose links Evangeline would recognize from any distance, a hideous medallion she could spot in any light. It was the chain her own mother had forged, the chain Marceline had carried with her into the dark man's heart. The girl was a mirror. The girl was Marceline. 18. Where the unusual occurs and miracles happen. Evangeline read the lettering on the wall of Old Charity Hospital by the glow of a fifolet, a will-o'-the-wisp ball of light she had conjured to illuminate the abandoned building's pitch-dark interior. She was sure Charity could deliver on the promised unusual, but doubted it had any miracles left to offer. She held her mother's chain in her balled fist. Its weight seemed to grow with each passing moment. She opened her hand and gazed down at the necklace. It appeared to be nothing out of the ordinary. A medallion and a collection of links fashioned from a metal some might call silver and others pewter. Both sides would be wrong. The metal from which her mother had created the necklace didn't belong in this world. A ceiling tile that held on since Katrina chose that very moment she looked away to tumble down and bounce off the arm of a hideous blue faux leather chair. A scurrying sound overhead revealed the cause of the drop. She shuddered and willed the light to move along, a trick Luke had taught her. She floated along behind it, her feet a good foot and a half above the detritus-strewn floor. This trick she had taught herself. The walls of the corridor were lined with tiles, the light of her globe gleaming on their glossy surface. A few yards ahead, she spotted a very human silhouette. The torso of a CPR dummy stood sentry. It was risky to open herself up to the energies lurking in such a place, but the medical center's three towers and their connector covered a million square feet, and even though the demons had retreated, she wasn't so sure they wouldn't circle back and maybe bring reinforcements with them. She could spend hours bobbing up and down around the hospital's collection of forgotten horrors, or she could send out the tiniest ping to see what would bounce back to her. She didn't want to risk getting swatted down like a wasp, so out of caution she sought a clear spot in the wall and lowered herself until her feet touched the floor. She dismissed her guiding light, then braced a hand against the wall's cool tile. But she was still unprepared for the force that responded to the burst of energy she sent out. She had feared being overwhelmed by any spirits that might still haunt these halls, but it wasn't the energy of lost souls that rebounded on her. It was the essence of the hospital itself. The building's memories had given it life, and its heart had been broken when the city deserted it. It mourned. It suffered. The grief was too intense, too palpable not to address. "I'm sorry." Evangeline spoke the words in her mind, then found herself unable to hide the thought the hospital would no doubt someday, possibly soon, be cleared away. "I'm sorry," she repeated the words aloud. Evangeline heard a whirring sound, and at the end of the hall, elevator doors sprung open. A light blinked on inside the car. She felt the building itself impress images onto her mind's eye. A room with peeling aqua walls. Large, irregular white patches showed through the spots where the paint had fallen away. The effect could have been monstrous, but it put Evangeline in mind of clouds in a summer sky. On one side, the room held a twin bed, a regular one, not the adjustable electronic ones usually found in patient rooms. On the other side stood a wooden desk. Positioned between them was a small, round table holding one of the room's two mismatched, utterly non-infirmary-style lamps. The current had been cut to the entire floor, so neither lamp could be the source of dim, bluish light that fell short of filling the space. Despite the room's wretched state, it appeared to be clean, like someone had tried to make the space livable. The elevator sounded a bing, expressing its willingness to carry Evangeline to the floor the room was on. Out of respect for its feelings, she decided to walk to the elevator rather than float to it,
regardless of the possible tetanus risk. As she took the first step, a force that felt like a marriage of wind and static electricity blew up around her and began sweeping the debris that had collected in the hall to either side. As she prepared to step into the elevator car, she paused and ran her hand down the wall, a soothing caress, she hoped. You were a good friend to this city. You deserve better. She stepped into the elevator, and its doors closed behind her. The car lifted up, its cables grinding like gnashing teeth, till it reached one of the upper floors. The doors opened onto darkness. As she exited the elevator, its light flashed off, and a soft moan spilled out behind her. She felt the energy of the hospital fall back, and it struck her that the ailing hospital had expended more effort than it could afford to help her. Thank you, she said, willing the spirit of the place a bit of healing magic to repay the favor. She snapped her fingers to reignite the fifolet. Its glow illuminated a placard reading, Staff Dorm Rooms. She stared down the length of the corridor. Some rooms remained closed off, but many of the doorways gaped open before her. The rooms they opened onto, silent, dark, long since abandoned. Only one doorway was different. Through it shone a pale glow so faint, Evangeline could hardly discern it. She sent her own light forward, following behind until she found herself standing at the incongruous opening. Inside the dilapidated dorm room, sitting at the desk in the glow of a camping lantern, was the child Marceline. She looked up at Evangeline, the bluish electric light accenting her large gray eyes and the dark circles beneath them. Un fifolet, Marceline said, nostalgia underlining each syllable. We used to send out fifolets, Margot and I, to lure lost travelers farther into the wilds. We'd follow, watching from above, wagering on whether they would survive the journey. Her sentimental tone left no doubt these were happy memories. I always let Margot be the one to predict their demise, even though I knew she'd win our little game 70% of the time. But then again, for me, it was never about winning. Yeah. Evangeline willed the illumination to fade. Good times. She focused on the small face before her, a shade whiter in the lantern's bluish light. Marceline's eyes ran her up and down. You are aware you can conjure the clothes you were wearing back. Evangeline blushed, not so much from modesty as from being treated as the amateur, at least compared to her aunt, she was. Just, Marceline swept her hands before her, and click your heels 3 times. Before Evangeline could act, Marceline's tiny face broke into a smile. I'm only joking about the clicking, but... She again made the motion with her hand. Evangeline mimicked the gesture, and indeed it worked. She was once again fully clothed, shirt to shoes. Is this some kind of glamour? Evangeline said, her head spinning as it tried to wrap itself around the idea the little girl before her could possibly be her mother's sister, the centuries-old witch Marceline. The girl's mouth tightened into a thin frown, and a look of caution crept into her eyes. She shook her head. No, child. The words sounded comical coming from the waif's lips. It is no glamour, no simple enchantment, no parlor trick. Prove it. Evangeline thrust the necklace at her. To her surprise, Marceline accepted it with a shrug, then slipped it around her neck and fixed its clasp. It rested on her small chest only for a moment,
before the links of the chain separated themselves from one another and fell with almost inaudible clinks to the floor.
It's lost its power,
Evangeline said, even as she watched the links snake back together. Marceline leaned over and caught hold of the mended chain.
Non, ma chère,
she said, holding the necklace out to Evangeline.
I've lost mine.
Evangeline couldn't bring herself to touch the necklace.
How can it be? You were there.
She laid the chain on the desk, then turned on her chair.
You witnessed the act yourself.
Her legs weren't long enough for her feet to reach the floor.
I commended myself to his will, and he freed me from this damnable charm your Marin boy hung around my neck. But it pleased him to bring me back as such.
She gestured, running her hand from head to knee. As I was on the day, my sisters and I ventured into the deep black pines to seek him out.
But you couldn't have been more than 10. I was 10 years old when I chose to barter my soul to the devil. The same age as Margot. Muret, your mother, was 8. We three considered Mathilde our leader. She was of marrying age. Almost 13.
I had no idea.
What? Did you believe we were always as you had known us to be?
I never really considered.
We were powerless, starving, Marceline cut her off, when we met him. Though we were hardly unique in those aspects. It was winter in the year of someone else's lord, 1693. Bad weather, poor harvests, war, fear, and greed. The perfect recipe for famine. La grande famine. We were all 4 orphans. Or as good as. We slipped into the forest, determined to find magic or die there from exposure. We left the village on the Jour de Saints Innocents, the massacre of innocents. Not a calculated move, but notable for the maudlin poetry of coincidence, no? We discovered we were far from the first to seek him out. We encountered a dozen corpses, maybe more. Some strangers, some faces we had known all our lives. Some on their knees, hands frozen together in supplication. Some half-eaten. By wolves, Mathilde told us, knowing her story was far less frightening than the reality. But I divined the truth. My stomach rumbled. Meat is meat. I think we amused him, we four. The plain and once pious Mathilde, the always foolhardy and on occasion foolish Margot. Your beautiful, timid mother, Mireille. And I, the exacting little ball crusher who believed herself capable of negotiating the deal. Margot, she would have sold her soul for the guarantee of one hot meal a day. Mathilde couldn't see past the horned mask, the faith she'd abandoned forced on him. I led him away from the others after receiving their agreement to abide by the bargain I struck. I saw the face behind the lie, and the force hiding again behind that. I sensed the depth of his power to mold reality and demanded that he make us queens rather than handmaidens. If only he had been the devil, we might have found ourselves in the 8th circle with Ericto, 4th pit from the left, she added with an unexpected wink. But the depths of hell would still have provided both a level of certainty and a firm foundation. With the dark man, there is nothing but leisure demand and shifting sand. I thought I'd worked through every intricacy of the negotiation, indenture or damnation. For the other two and myself, it didn't matter. But I haggled long and hard for Millet and won her the opportunity to slip free of his bond before death. Of course, he found a way to turn that.
He always finds a way to twist your dream into a curse. He left Miolet burdened by the conscience whose call we others stopped hearing. Or at least attending to over time. Much less time than you might suspect. Her burdensome conscience was what drove her to marry the preacher, hypocrite that he was, and to the creation of that damnable necklace. She tried to change. She wanted to. Yes, the poor fool tried to free herself. Marceline lay her hand beside the chain. Through bondage, but she never stood a chance. She lifted the necklace, offering it once again to Evangeline. Tiens. She reached out and grasped Evangeline's hand, dropping the simple chain into her open palm. Look at it. See it. Not as an instrument of torture. Not as a hated object. Not as an object at all, but as the energy of which it's composed, and the vibration of that energy. Evangeline could feel the chain and medallion begin to pulsate in time, she realized, with her own pulse. Its links seemed to quiver. Then they emitted a blinding flash and morphed into a new necklace. A cascade of teardrop emeralds and round diamonds caught in shimmering gold. Evangeline held the jewels up, barely able to believe her eyes. She knew this necklace. She recognized it from the night of the massacre. Julia Prosper had worn these very emeralds to her own murder. Evangeline tossed the necklace to the desk, where it shimmered and returned to the simple chain that had once burned into her own flesh. But I had this chain, she pointed at where it lay, with me in my bag, when Julia entered the hall wearing the emeralds. They may have appeared to be separate, but they are and always have been one. They are two expressions of the same energy. I don't understand. Nor did I. None until I passed through his heart. Before that moment, I saw myself as cursed. She shook her head, the young face taking on a weariness far beyond its apparent years. Mireille's chain was created to separate a witch from her magic. Inanna's necklace of diamonds and emeralds, seven of each to be precise, was manifested to allow a witch who comprehends the seven mysteries to focus her own power and claim that of others, to ascend until she touches the heavens. But the homely chain that deprives and the exquisite necklace that gives are one in the same. There is no separation. There are no dichotomies. There is only polarization.
The seven mysteries?
Yes, the seven mysteries. Every culture addresses them after a fashion. The Buddhists' seven factors of enlightenment offer a release from the illusion of selfhood. The seven principles of Hermes Trismegistus promise to dissolve the illusion of a material world. The seven wounds of the cross teach Christ's followers they can redeem themselves through the surrender of self. The seven seals of John the Revelator have been interpreted a thousand ways, but all point to the end of reality as we know it. Inanna passed through seven gates of the underworld, and at each gate, the goddess surrendered another belonging, another symbol of self, to arrive at wisdom, the absolute reality of non-existence. Not death, tu vois, but a descent into chaos. And at the same time, a flight into the realm of infinite possibility. Like a magnet's poles, opposite but one. Theodosius, our famous mad monk who gave us the Book of the Unwinding, began as a manuscript finder for Pope Nicholas V, seeking out those texts His Holiness wouldn't want to publicly acknowledge. Theodosius had been charged with traveling to France to discover and collect any remaining tomes that had belonged to the Avignon papacy. Marceline leaned in as if to whisper a secret.
By the way, she said, there were 7 of them, you know, the popes of Avignon.
She touched the side of her nose and nodded. Evangeline remembered that a power struggle between one of the long-ago popes and a king of France had led to a brief period when the seat of power of the Catholic Church shifted from Rome to French city of Avignon. But the details of the conflict were lost to her.
The diligent young cleric Theodosius, Marceline continued without missing a beat, as if she expected Evangeline to carry an encyclopedic knowledge of the intricate relationship between church and state in the late Middle Ages, was carrying out his faithful completion of his mission when the old Cathar heresy planted new seeds in his fevered, fertile mind. He stumbled upon the mysteries through the Cathar interpretation of the story of Salome and her dance of the 7 veils, a tale I would expect to resonate with you, given your chosen line of business. Of course, Evangeline knew the story. Her father had denounced the millennia dead woman with the same fervor with which he came after the female contemporaries he judged to be harlots. Forget that man. Even bereft of her magic, Marceline seemed to have discerned her thoughts.
It's certain you have more Langeac in you than Casey.
Yes, she said, her chin raised in pride. You are one of the Langeac women.
She clenched her hand and touched it to her heart, an unstudied gesture that betrayed more emotion than Marceline had likely intended.
From Mende? She said, lowering her hand, recovering. In the Lozère region?
Before they named it the Lozère.
The two-faced pulpiteer knew that, I'm sure, but I'm not surprised he kept those facts from you.
Her youthful features hardened as her cheeks flushed red. A furious loathing for Evangeline's father played in her eyes.
Salome, Evangeline said, to bring Marceline back before her rage ignited Evangeline's own, performed a kind of striptease for the king to capture the head of John the Baptist.
Yes, Marceline said. A look like gratitude's poor relation crossed her face, then faded away in the next instant.
Salome danced, enticing her king, liberating herself from each of her 7 veils. Symbols, of course, of what stands between the seeker and her enlightenment. The Cathars, though, they went a bit further in their interpretation of the text. To them, John the Baptist had come as an emissary of the devil, to act as foil to the Christian Messiah, the Antichrist, if you will. But that wasn't the Cathars' true heresy. Their tenets posited the two personages, Christ and the Antichrist, were not individual beings, but polarizations of a single, inseparable energy.
The necklace. Evangeline found herself drawing closer to the desk, her finger tracing the surface on which the chain lay.
Why 14 stones?
The diamonds are the 7 stars of La Grande Chariot, better known in this land under the prosaic name Big Dipper. The 7 emeralds of Inanna's necklace combined to form the emerald tablet of Hermes Trismegistus Kybalion. The 14 stones together express the principle of correspondence, as above, so below.
The Kybalion, Hermes Trismegistus, names to conjure with literally. Some consider the Kybalion to be the arch grimoire, the greatest modern treatise on magic, and most held Hermes Trismegistus, Hermes the thrice great, to be an incarnation of the entity known in ancient Greece as Hermes, ancient Rome as Mercury, and ancient Egypt as the great god Thoth.
the god of writing and father of all sciences, the architect of physical reality. Hermes Trismegistus was said to have recorded the secret of spinning the energy of the eternal chaos into matter. The supreme act of magic, on what Evangeline had always thought to be a fabled emerald tablet. But if there was even a glimmer of truth in what her aunt was telling her, the tablet was real and connected to Evangeline. Is my mother's connection to the necklace the reason why I'm different? I perceive you as being different in many ways. I'm unsure any of them coincide with the uniqueness to which you're referring. A genuine smile, a warm smile. Evangeline sensed neither guile nor sarcasm. Perhaps if you could pose a more succinct question. Magic is dying, Evangeline began.
Magic is fading,
Marceline joined her in a sing-song. The others, most of them have no magic of their own. They're clinging to depleted relics. But I...
You are sizzling with magic, like une serge magique.
She pursed her lips as she searched for the English term.
A sparkler.
Yes.
You are shooting sparks. Bright. Blinding.
Lincoln had advised her not to let her gains become common knowledge. She agreed that, for now, discretion was wise. But soon, it seemed, she might not have to worry. Only Alice came anywhere near her in power. Alice herself had made a point of showing her hand with the fireworks she displayed at Pré-sur-Seine. And a great chasm was growing between them and the rest. Even though Nicholas's grand scheme had emboldened him, he was looking for a new battery, while Evangeline could sense lightning bolts of power playing beneath her skin. Ironic, the swamp witch might end up the last witch standing.
What can I say, ma chère fille? Magic has always played favorites.
Marceline studied her face. As I descended through the heart of madness, I learned the most salient facts in regard to magic's demise. She hesitated, as if waiting for Evangeline's permission to share. Evangeline nodded.
There is something I need to show you, but it will require the eyes of another for you to see it. You must arrange a meeting with the Marin girl, Alice.
The sister witches had conspired with Celestin. Celestin, who had locked Alice away on the dreaming road.
I'm not sure Alice will be willing. Make her be willing. Luke needs you. He needs both of you.
19. A text from Nicholas.
I know you and Hugo are still out. I've sent the rolls to bring you to the house.
Headlights flashed at them as she read the line. Hugo, in the middle of commenting on a leftover bill announcing La Laurie Marchand's farewell tour, shielded his eyes with his hand. Alice tapped his shoulder and handed him her phone. The fresh air of the wee hours had somewhat revived her. But rolls are no rolls. Only one destination held any interest for her. Bed. He read the message and grimaced.
Do you see now why I don't carry one of these things?
He dropped the phone back into her hand and started walking toward the car.
Well, come on then.
Wait, you're going?
Hugo turned to face her, walking backward toward the black sedan.
No, he said, waving her forward. We are.
Alice hesitated, but Hugo bounded ahead. A man dressed in charcoal gray slacks and a white button down popped out from behind the wheel and opened the rear door.
Sup?
Hugo nodded at the driver and climbed in. He stuck his head out and focused on Alice.
Come on. The leader awaits.
The car slowed to a stop before